For ZDNet, this is Dan Farber. You're listening to a podcast of the 2007 MIT CIO Symposium held on May 17th, 2007. First, a word from our sponsor. This is the fourth annual summit presented by the MIT Sloan Alumni Club of Boston, the MIT Center for Digital Business, and the Society for Information Management. This year's theme was Networks for Competitive Advantage, People, Partners, and Processes. Here's the keynote speech by Charlie Feld, Senior Executive Vice President for Application Services at EDS, entitled Always On, Working in the World of Now.
The Internet, you know, this whole notion really shrunk the earth, and as information flowed back and forth, and even Eastern Europe came down because Radio Free Europe used to be a trickle. And once information started flowing, things started changing rapidly. So the acceleration really started happening in the late 80s, really during the dot-com boom, really started accelerating even further as the networks enabled this kind of globalization. The other part of it is the edge explosion, all of the edge devices, the instant messaging, the web-enabled, the self-service, the pervasive edge, the RFID, fairly routine as you drive through toll booths now, but wasn't routine in the 80s. You'd have to stop, take the change out of your pocket, and put it into the little slot. Our kids won't even know what that is, right? They just drive through at 60 miles an hour and think that's the way life is. So, you know, all of this edge technology combined to accelerate the globalization, but the real business change, I don't know what happened, I'm looking at it here, so. The real business change came across both of those because those two things began to change who did the work, right? Customers wanted to do their own work, and I was at an airline in the late 90s as we moved from call center agents, res agents, travel agents and people in airports that had the information that you had to stand in line to get to self-service kiosks and mobile devices, mobile check-in, right, and everything else, and then the whole Amazon, eBay phenomenon. So who does the work now is the customer, right? When they do it is their choice, and if it's in a global world, 2 o'clock in the morning is 2 o'clock in the afternoon someplace, so it never shuts down. Right? And how the work is done, right, is done on whatever device they want to use. So it's not people going into buildings where you can lock down security and you can make sure only good guys get on your network, right? It changed where, when, and how work got done. The other thing that started changing is the very successful companies of the 20th century, the industrial era, many of the companies that I've worked in and have worked with, you know, they were based on the more stuff you own, the more assets, right? The workforce, the plants, the, you know, the more stuff you owned, the better life was, the more powerful you were. And as you flip into the 21st century, the less stuff you own, the more powerful you are, because the more flexible you are to move work around and to, you know, to change the economics as the world ebbs and flows. So the notion of fixed cost, small variable, right, is what life was like in the 20th century. In the 21st century, is people are looking to get their fixed cost down to as small as they can get it, right, and push the burden off on suppliers and customers and so forth, and have lots of variable costs, which is what drives a lot of the outsourcing, because you can take it up, shut it down, take it up, shut it down, move work from India to China to Latin America back to Eastern Europe, as opposed to most of the successful companies in the 21st century poured a lot of concrete, had a lot of plants, had a lot of people, right? And now things like portable pensions and everything else, right? So if you look at those beliefs, the globalization really driven by edge, changing the way work is done, right, changing what a corporation or an enterprise really looks like going forward in terms of assets and people, more virtual, more of an ecosystem, than most of the companies we work in, unless you happen to work at Amazon or eBay or MySpace. I mean, if you work at any successful company during the 20th century, they got a lot of stuff. They got plants, they got systems, they got networks, they got people, they got pensions, and they are really struggling to transform, right? And even the marketplace is not allowing people to transform and make the investment, because the way the 20th century markets were built is quarter-to-quarter profit, right? So you see a lot more privatization going on now because people can't get out of their own way, make the investments that they need to make in order to transform, and if they don't do that, they won't survive. So, you know, that is the general backdrop of what's happened, and it's happened over time, right? But it's accelerated and is becoming geometric now, and most people that moved late are really going to struggle, and many won't survive, okay? Now, when you look at what that means to an enterprise, and this could be a military enterprise, a government, it could be a commercial enterprise, this notion of a seamless enterprise that allows anybody to get in anytime, anywhere, right, whether it's suppliers connected, right, or it's customers connected, or employees doing their own self-service, requires a very different business process, technology, and infrastructure than most of us have. Most of us have built things that are employee-based, that are, you know, you mail things in, people key them in, they run through batch systems, right? And over the years, most organizations are not seamless or agile or, you know, whatever people want to call it, but that's the target. Now, the interesting part for me is I saw this actually, and this is the model, and some of you, I know the folks that from MIT have been through the Frito-Lay case studies. Now, they're dated, they're 20 years old, and the technology of mobile technology on route trucks we did in 1986, 87, it was a big deal then, and I'm kind of surprised that people are still teaching the case study. But the reason they're teaching the case study 20 years later, it had little to do with the technology and a lot more to do with the business model, right? Of being able to build a high-speed, event-enabled organization that was large and had tremendous velocity through. And what I called it when we designed the system was the Herman Lay model, because I happened to meet Herman when he was 83 years old. I'd just become the CIO at Frito in 1980, and I spent, you know, a few afternoons with him just talking about the business. And if you have the founder still in your company, you ought to go talk to him. They really have phenomenal wisdom about how to think about the business. And what Herman said was, look, you know, when I started the business, I bought potatoes, I cooked them, I put them in bags, I took them to the stores, and I collected the money, right? That's all we still do. So he was talking about process-driven, not manufacturing and sales, and right? So, but he was the perfect system because, you know, he was event-enabled. He was able to see if he had cash to buy more. He was able to see what the competitors were doing because he was in the stores. If he didn't cook them right, he had a quality problem. It was the perfect system. And, you know, as it started growing, he kept a few principles in mind that he wanted me to pay attention to as I took this company that was now multi-billion dollars, very stovepipe, very functional. And he said, look, you know, stay on what we do. We make, move, and sell, right? Don't lose the picture of that. And there wasn't a notion of process engineering at that point. But he also said, you know, we need to make sure that we don't have all these MBAs that Callaway and Rico and Jordan are hiring talk anybody into more than a three-day warehouse, right? I mean, he was Michael Dell. I didn't know it at the time because he said we have a 35-day shelf life, and if you build more than a three-day warehouse, you're going to get more than 3 days' worth of inventory. So constrain the warehouse and make them push the product through, because otherwise you'll end up with stales that have to be removed. And that, you know, those little ideas stuck with me as we started designing the new system for Frito. right? And, you know, as we designed and implemented the Herman Lay model, and you start thinking about it 20 years later, if car manufacturers had cars that would go, that would melt in 35 days in the lot, they wouldn't make so many cars, right? They'd have to have less steel. They'd have to make it almost to order, right? And they'd have to have fast inventories around it. And, you know, what we did is we built a seamless enterprise in 1985. Now, I mean, the network wasn't as fancy. It was more store and forward. You know, the internet wasn't around. The handheld was like a brick that people carried. But the idea of event-enabled, data-centric, process-centric, rules-driven, right, all of the fundamentals of what people are looking to go do were built in the mid-80s. You know, when we started working with Walmart, because Walmart was the customer then that was big enough, much like the customers now in the airline business. I mean, the customer owns it. Well, Walmart owned it. I don't know if there's anybody here from Walmart, but in the 80s, they started dictating to us where they wanted it, when they wanted it, at what price they wanted it. And basically what they were doing was this fixed variable thing, because they were giving us the privilege of putting our product on their shelf, right? They got paid long before they paid us, which forced us to drive our supply chain in a different way, right? Which began the big change. So, you know, 20 some years ago, we saw the change. And when you look at, you know, the advantages they had, right? You know, they knew the inventory that was flowing through. They made responses to it. And all that's happening now is RFID is making it go faster. But the notion of centralized data, centralized data models, centralized business processes, right, as opposed to everything being decentralized, right, every store having their own power, every place having their own, every division having their own systems. And again, RFID, all it does is accelerate the process, make it more granular, but the basic principles are the same. Now, the important part of the learning coming out of the 80s into the 90s is that when you watch those two organizations work, and I really haven't stayed that much in touch with it. I left in 92 and started my own company, which was a CIO for hire company, and that's where I got into the airlines and the railroads and credit card processing and so forth. It was phenomenal. It was a high-speed system that was open, fast-moving, because we were, you know, we had the same system for us. We were the customer of our suppliers, and we told them where to be and what to do. And then at the head end of it was Walmart, right, who was driving the change, right? And everybody that was decentralized struggled, right? Whether they were Walmart's competitors on the left-hand side or Frito-Lay's competitors on the right-hand side, because they were structured in a very decentralized way. Their systems were stovepipe. It was more product-oriented, right? And frankly, you know, in people that have franchise, Pepsi-Cola was our sister company, and there were 87 or 89 Pepsi-Colas across the U.S. Walmart was not interested in 87 bills. They were not interested with negotiating with 87 different Pepsis. So the centralization, decentralization thing really started showing up. Now, what we're seeing when you come forward to now is it's happening in every industry. You know, war is not fought with tanks anymore and big bases all over the globe, right? It's a mobile military, right? You got to be able to pick up and move things. Networks are more important than buildings and facilities. In consumer goods, the Walmart effect continues. In healthcare, things are starting to break down. In financial services, same kind of thing. The whole notion of self-service, rapidly moving systems, no inventory standing still, right, and so forth is happening everywhere around the globe. And what I see is we're at a crossroads, and here's where I think we need to really get what's going on. And I use the notion of a Medici effect, because you can't look at infrastructure, and you can't look at applications, and you can't look at business processes, and you can't look at business models separately They're welded together. A modern business requires modern business processes, requires modern software, and if you have all those three, you better have a modern infrastructure, right? Because you're not driving that across a frame relay network with old password and security. So you got a welded conversation going on now where everything needs to move at the same time. And really, the answer is not in any one of the roads. It's in the intersections, right? Because entertainment, information, networks, they all begin to converge. Personal life begin to converge with business life, right? So the answer is to step back and understand the patterns around you and how it could affect your industry. For example, if you stood back and looked at what's possible, we could fix the healthcare system in this country, connecting payers, doctors, patients, very decentralized industry. But given the technology and given the internet and given the self-service, we can connect all those communities in ways that we could actually deliver healthcare, because we have a great healthcare capability, but the delivery system is pretty broken. Now, when you look at what that means, it means always on. It's the stuff you talk about, you read about, always on, self-service, flexible, scale, because once you go to self-service, you've got to have flexible networks, you've got to have surge capacity, because you don't know if 100,000 people are going to get on because there's a thunderstorm in Dallas, and everybody wants to get on and see what's happening. And those are the principles of this notion of a seamless enterprise. And when you net it out, and I try to oversimplify things, because most of the time, the IT folks get it, but most of the business people really struggle with these words, with SOA, with client server, with they're not interested in that. What they do understand, though, is the notion of self-service, the notion of getting people to do the work themselves begins to change the game. So at the airlines that I did, two airlines, Southwest Airlines and Delta Airlines, what they wanted was self-service kiosks. They wanted mobile check-in. They wanted RFID tags on baggage, on and on. And, what it did is it took 10,000 people out of the airports at Delta. It took 12,000 people out of the res centers. It cut the travel agent expense from $2 billion to $1 billion. Big numbers. And it also improved customers who wanted to feel like they were in control. The flip side of it is it changed the business model because customers began to see price transparency. They began to shop, right? So it switched, the power base got switched. So Priceline showed up and, Expedia, Travelocity, right? And now, it's really changed the business model. It took cost out for sure, but it also took the margin pressure because people can switch and shop. There's no loyalty. Unless you could develop intimacy at that point at the top, an ATM's an ATM. What I care. I don't know Fred the teller. So, I don't have the intimacy. So achieving that is what's on everybody's mind, taking cost out, getting to better systems. The problem is what people have is what they have, right? Because we have 40 years of bridges that don't kind of come together and roads that don't exactly work because it was built in a different time. And you can't walk away from that stuff. And the whole idea is to connect what you have with what you want, and that's, you can call it composite solutions, you can call it SOA, you can call it whatever you want, but it's not much different than we did in the 80s, right? It's good engineering, right? Although it's made easier by the technology, the messaging middleware, the event-enabled stuff, the data schemas, the MDMs, all of those things contribute, but normalizing the data structures, pulling the workflows into a harmonization layer, getting the business rules exposed, enable you to take an old TPF system, which is where the reservation systems are, a baggage handling system, a flight maintenance system, a crew calling system, a flight ops system, all written in different technologies, and really the value is in none of them. The reason that airlines get turned upside down is not because you'll lose bags, it's not because of the baggage handling system, It does what it does. It handles bags. The baggage handling system doesn't know where the planes are. The planes don't know where the people are. So the idea of, if you want the answer at the top, is this plane on time, right? You got to connect those things. So rather than spend a lot of money down inside of that, get up to the abstraction layer and build the connection points and then begin to replace the other stuff. And then, you know, it's a different sport. You can never go down, right? There are no change windows available. Once everybody's on, you can't go mess with this thing, right? The other thing that's important is during the mainframe era, we actually focused on not just the build cost. Everybody worries about the investment I need to make to go build this. During the mainframe era, we actually worried about the run costs because it was very expensive. If you didn't design to run, you ended up buying another mainframe. It was a $5 million, $7 million cost. When we got into the client-server environment, people said, well, don't worry about all that. Servers are cheap. This is cheap. That's cheap. Well, they're cheap unless you have 10,000 of them at 15% utilization or 20% utilization, and you got people running around touching them and chasing them, right? My point of view, and I've seen some of these implementations already starting to happen, is you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, if you do this poorly, right, and you make these connection points because of all of the the lack of control over people, the number of people that get on, right, the surge capacity required, the network pressure for all the messaging back and forth, and the instantaneous nature of this stuff, the fact that it could never go down, so you've got to have enough capacity to fail over, right? If you don't design this right, you'll run it off the wheels, and this will be the most expensive era that people have ever seen. And therefore, designing it for run, making sure it's engineered right, making sure the quality's there, because once it's up, I mean, you'll stop an airline from running. You'll stop a bank. You'll stop a consumer goods company because you've already taken the people out of the airports. There are no people in the res centers anymore. Right, you'll get a disaster on your hands. And then you've got to understand that those legacy systems are part of this, and they're going to be there for some period of time, so investing some in making them more resilient. Get the dead code out, get it documented. Legacy systems are not by nature bad. They just get so gnarled up with so many if-then-else statements and so many add-ons, right? But if they're part of that composite, any one of those composites break and nothing happens. The TPF system goes down, it doesn't matter, right? You can't get to that. And then really build it for operations. Make sure the change windows, you know, you're almost building operating system level stuff, and you can't have programmers get in the middle of any of this stuff at any point in time and start changing it without good change control and, you know, release management. And we, fortunately, over the years, we've begun to develop standards, right? So you've got to have a very structured operating world. Now, the important part of this, and then I'll try to wrap up, is, you know, it's not reasonable to think that people have a decade to go off and replace everything. They don't have the money, they don't have the time, nor is it reasonable to think that you can't do anything about this, right? So the notion is modernize what you have. Begin from where you are and then, you know, get business value and then start replacing and making the point solutions healthier, get rid of them. Because we're in an era where people are not going to write a lot of code. It's mostly integration of packages and legacy code and everything else. Now, in order to do that, you've got to have more than a project proposal cycle, right? You've got to lay out a multi-year plan. You've got to lay out a journey because what you're doing won't end on any one calendar year, and you're not asking for a baggage handling system. You're not asking for a crew calling system, right? You're asking to change business processes, to build a modern business model that's always on, that's connected, that people can access, right? you're trying to build intimacy into it. The technology becomes so critical that you've got to lay out a multi-year plan. Now, I've been on executive committees for 28 years now, and I'll tell you, being in the room is interesting because Every other function in the room lays out a multi-year plan. You look at people that control the fleets, the manufacturing organizations. They don't decide to build a plant in September of this year, fund it for January to December, stop building the plant as soon as they hit any kind of financial problem. You finish the plant, right? They lay out a multi-year plan. They say, I got 40 plants. What I want to do is I've got to reshape them. I've got to shut down these three. I've got to build 4 mega plants over here. I've got to, you know, same thing's true with fleet. They don't decide they want to get rid of all the 727s and L-1011s in one calendar year. You got what you got, but you got to have a vision of what you're trying to get done to replace this thing. And that is the toughest part of the CIO job, is in that room laying out the same kind of notion of a multi-year journey, of which you then pull down 1 year's worth of investment, right? Now, the other thing to watch out for is this is the common wisdom right now that IT costs are going to go down. IT costs are not going to go down. Get over it, right? I mean, what's going to happen is the metrics should go down because you should begin to change the mix, right? We should get better metrics, fewer people, not chasing servers around all over the place and everything else. But what you're looking at is a lot more devices, right? You're putting out thousands of flat screens, virtual servers that can scale, disaster recovery. You know, I mean, it's the number of devices. It's the intensity of RFID and scanners in the warehouses, and it's not the cost per device, right? And therefore, the business justification needs to come out of the business, because we're really penetrating the business now. We're changing the manufacturing cycle. We're changing the supply chain costs, right? And therefore, the total business case needs to be made, not I'm going to do IT cheaper, right? You can't get caught in that trap. Now, you should be expected that your unit cost goes down. You should be expected that your metrics get better. But the total cost won't go down with so many devices and so much pressure on the system, which means after 40 years of being here in the 60s, you know, when I was a systems engineer, I guarantee you the executive committee in the companies that I was working at had no idea where the computer room was or who the DP manager was, right? They were buried in the organization. In the 70s, what happened was some of the function heads started showing up, not the executive committee, but one level down, and they said, hey, build me a manufacturing thing. Build me a this, build me a that. Right, and that's where we started the functional stovepipes. In the 80s, all of a sudden, it wasn't a $5 million machine like it was in the 60s. It wasn't a $500,000 mini computer like it was in the 70s. It was a $5,000 PC, right? People said, I could go do that. And that's when even the functions got busted up with LANs all over their functions and everything else. And then in the late 90s, people started coming down and saying, man, we're spending a lot of money on this stuff and nobody's happy. There's nothing in a company that people spend more money on and make people more miserable than IT costs, right? At least if I'm going to spend that kind of money, people should be happy, right? And now what's happened is it is that laminated conversation. And the business executives have got to pay attention and understand. And the IT organization has got to understand business, and that gap's got to get closed. That gap was closed at maybe a dozen places in the 80s, maybe 100 places in the 90s, and maybe 200 places now. But it's getting better, but we got to get better quicker, because unless you have that notion of a real conversation, you can't build a multi-year plan, right, and then build to run without ending up with more assets and people. So this term IT governance and how do you run an IT organization is now has to professionalize and has to go end to end, because in these kind of solutions, you got to plan it across the enterprise, not inside of a function. You've got to design it big and deliver it small, because if you don't have the architectures, the security architecture, the data structures, if you don't have that design before you start building, these roads will never come together. And then you got to get into an executable release rhythm of 6 to 9 months. I'm putting a piece out there. I'll do gate and boarding, then I'll do the kiosks, then I'll do the, you know, and you build off of that. And you've got to fund it from the total business. You're taking it out of the cost structure of the business and you're investing it into IT. So that's kind of in a nutshell, you know, what I believe CIOs are up against. I think that it is a very exciting time, but it's also a very dangerous time. It's a dangerous time if you don't get it sold, and it's a dangerous time because your company may go away. Right? And it's a dangerous time if you get it sold and you don't understand the build characteristics and how industrial strength this stuff needs to be in order to make it work. Okay, so that kind of sets the tone. And again, I know this is, you know, driven around this connectivity environment, but inside of that, this notion of always on, right, it is critical. You know, as people move into the future, and you know, we're at a very exciting point in our history. We've learned a lot. We've made every mistake you can make. We've built enough bridges that don't stand, right? And now we've got to reconstruct the cities. So, thank you. Do I have time for any questions, or anybody have any questions, or probably pick them up in the roundtables?
I have one question for you. Is this on? Well, I can be loud. You spoke about rigidity and fragility at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So in legacy systems, you have these rigid systems in place, and then we have this communications infrastructure that is potentially fragile. How do you see a balance being struck in progressing rigid systems, but also not relying too much on maybe this infrastructure that perhaps not as well tested as it could be?
Yeah, I think the notion of rigidity, right, is, you know, I mentioned I did some work in the credit card business. The systems that were built in the 70s generally was when everybody in the room got 19% APR, right? Pretty simple stuff, right? Come forward 30 years, and you get a different one than you. And in fact, if you're going into Home Depot, and you're both going into Home Depot, you may get a different rate than you get. And if in Home Depot, GE put refrigerators on zero financing, and you know lumber is not, at the point of sale, it needs to understand that. Well, when you get into some of these systems, you can't put enough if-then-else statements for everybody in the population for every combination of everything, but that's what we did. We went into this code and we built complex logic instead of externalizing business rules, right? So the rigidity is, if you want to add new business rules, you better go get a programmer, right? That is not the way Travelocity works. That's not the way, you know, I mean, so getting those structures right. To do that, you've got to get your data structures right, right? So unwinding the rigidity is really critical, okay? And then when you talk about modernizing things that are in the infrastructure, and I won't just talk about the network, I'll talk about the infrastructure, right? You can't run always-on stuff on PDP-11s and VAXs. Right, I mean, I loved them at the time, so you've got to get it on, you know, more modern technology for that. So, you know, what I think my main message there is, if you took a slice and you went from network to servers and storage to, you know, messaging infrastructures to application logic, business rules, data, to business processes, to the business model, you got to move it all together, right? And you got to decide where you want to start rebuilding that city, because you got to live in the city while you're there. But you can't throw a lot of modern stuff on top of old, broken things. It just won't work. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the 2007 MIT CIO Symposium. For more information on this symposium, please visit MITCIO.com. For CDNet, I'm Dan Farber.